Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy and Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, and today my co-host will be Don Irvine, but we're doing it a little differently today, and Don will be on for the second guest. I'm going to be doing the interview with the first guest, and so I'm going to tell you about them right now, and hopefully we're going to have our guest on the line here very shortly. Our first guest is going to be Martin Gross, who I will tell you a little bit more about. He has a new book out called National Suicide, How Washington is Destroying the American Dream from A to Z. Then we have Andrew Moylan, the Director of Government Affairs from the National Taxpayers Union. And then after that, we have Virginia Walden Ford, who is the Executive Director of the D.C. Black Alliance for Educational Options. So it should be a very interesting show. We hope you will stay with us today. And in the meantime, again, I want to encourage you to visit our website, aim.org. I'll tell you a little about Cliff Kincaid has a column up today that I think you'll find very interesting. It's about someone that Fox News Channel has hired, Mark Lamont Hill, to be a news analyst. And Cliff found some very interesting websites and Twitter pages that have a lot of things that Mark and Fox apparently found rather embarrassing, and so since Cliff's column, he did one yesterday and then another one about this, and Mark has taken down a number of these things from his website, and Cliff points that out, and we're going to have more on that later because we made copies of them before they came on, so before he took them down, rather. So anyway, Martin Gross, I don't know how many of you are familiar with him, but he has had some amazing books, and he's talking about, he has looked into every aspect of the federal government and just the waste, the fraud, the abuse. It's really quite amazing. And what he has shown. He's done books on medicine. We're going to talk to him about a number of these different topics, and you will find him quite fascinating, I'm sure. I'm looking forward to this interview very much. Anyway, interestingly, this morning on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, there was a person on from another organization called, let's see here, sorry about this, Maya McGinnis of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And she talked about one thing is how the interest on the national, national debt, the national deficit, this year made up 11.2% of our total GDP, and that was up from 3.2% just a year ago. And it's just an incredible, unsustainable level of debt that we are getting ourselves into. And what you'll find out from this conversation with Martin Gross is that so much of it is so unnecessary and so wasteful and so political in nature, it's hard to believe. Here's Mr. Gross on the line right now. I'm going to bring him on.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Well, I appreciate your being with us. I've been reading little bits from your book, particularly the chapter on government foolishness, to give our audience an idea of what's in this book. But let me, now that I have you on the line, I'm going to introduce you. Martin Gross is an educator, columnist, and investigative reporter who has written a dozen nonfiction books on government, medicine, tax policy, national culture, and psychology. Perhaps his most famous and best-selling book was the classic The Government Racket, Washington Waste from A to Z. But his newest, and the one we want to talk about today, is National Suicide, How Washington is Destroying the American Dream from A to Z. Tell us about you. How did you come to be the person who, I would say, more than anyone has examined and analyzed how our government operates from a fiscal standpoint and from a policy standpoint?
I've covered Washington for 30 years, mostly as a syndicated national columnist. I was in all of the major papers except for the New York Times, which, of course, has no interest in good government. And the I crawled the halls. I read regularly the Government Accountability Office reports, and I worked with think tanks. And after 20 years ago, I decided that the situation was rotten, that the present situation was destroying America. And so in 1992, I wrote the book, The Government Racket. I subsequently testified six times before Congress, pointing out all its crimes, its ills, its stupidity, its ignorance. And they hailed me, you know, not all of them, but some of them said, well, you're right. And they were going to improve, but of course it only got worse, and I went into retirement and come out of retirement because the situation now is leading towards the end of America as we know it. And the basic cause is politics and spending. And we have a policy, a compulsion to spend money. It's very much like an alcoholic or a narcotic user that they can't stop themselves. And New Hampshire, which has no state income tax, solves their problem partially by not meeting. They only meet in concert about 3 months a year, and then they go home and become regular citizens. These people are professional money spenders, and then they tie their ideology to the spending, and the result is that America is really totally bankrupt and getting worse. Mr. Clinton increased the national debt $1.5 trillion. Mr. Bush increased it $3 trillion. Mr. Obama in just this year and next year is increasing it $3 trillion and $1 trillion more each year. And the government's already announced that it will be $9.3 trillion more in the next decade, ending in 2019, which will give us then $23 trillion deficit. Now, we're only paying 4.5% interest, but it's still $1 trillion. But that's nothing, because when the economy comes back, the 30-year bond will be 6%. And under Jimmy Carter, it was 16%. Now, if China says, I want more interest because you're near bankruptcy, and let's say it's 10%, and then you're going to have $2.3 trillion in wasted interest going to China, Japan, and domestic people, and the money is gone. It's wasted. And what will happen is you'll have no Medicare, you'll have no Social Security, you'll have nothing. The economy will be destroyed. You can't pay $2.3 trillion wasted interest on the national debt. And it got there because of total irresponsibility and ignorance of the presidency and the Congress. You know, they say that the president is the chief executive. He's executive of nothing. He's the chief politician. There's nobody running the government. If I asked Mr. Obama or Mr. Bush or Mr. Clinton 10 questions on the running of the government, they couldn't answer any of them. For example, I'd say, how many job training programs are there? There are 163. How many does France have? 2. Why? Because in the parliamentary system, the man who passes the legislation is the Minister of Labor. He executes it. So he doesn't want 163 programs making him look like a fool. But in America, nobody knows, nobody cares. Congress passes a bill, and they forget it the next day, and it stays on the books for 60 years. We have 27 programs for pregnant teenagers, 70 programs for juvenile narcotics usage, 163 job training programs, and there are thousands of programs. And my famous anecdote, which I'd only discovered the last week of my manuscript, was the head of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Des Moines, Iowa, said, my God, I got all these federal programs coming across my desk. I can't even keep track of them. How many are there? So he hired Stanford Research to find out, and they came back with an 81-page report saying these programs overlap, they're stupid, no one knows what's going on, some have been on the book for 70 years. And he found out that there are 1,399 federal programs just for disappearing poor rural areas. So the government doesn't function, has no chief executive.
Amazing.
And it lies all the time, by the way, lies all the time.
Well, one of the things that I think it lies about is how much is our annual national deficit. You have pointed out how Clinton claims to have left us with a surplus for the last two or three years of his presidency, but in fact we really never were in surplus, and then the figures continue to be a lie, don't they?
They lie every day, all day. Mr. Clinton claimed about $500 billion surplus for the 8 years. And then every year, the Treasury Department must, by law, conduct an audit. By the way, the new one's going to be released today, every October 1. They found out that he wasn't $500 billion in surplus. It was approximately $500 billion in deficit. Mr. Bush supposedly in his last year had $400-odd billion in deficit. It was $750 billion in deficit. Now, why the discrepancy? The reason is because the government has a false accounting system. They have a cash basis, meaning they only deal with cash in, cash out. But no corporation deals with that. They deal in GAAP accounting terms, which is all borrowing has to be included within. Now, the government borrows from itself by stealing the Social Security surplus every year. Up until 2016, there's a continuing surplus because Mr. Greenspan raised the premiums 25% in 1983. And that, so far, the government has stolen $2.5 trillion from Social Security and given it worthless IOUs. And the reason they're worthless is because they make up a quarter of the national debt, which everybody who beyond kindergarten knows cannot be ever repaid. So you have to re-raise the Social Security money to pay for the baby boomers, 78 million strong. So the government is not only a liar, but it's a compulsive, psychopathic liar, because a Democrat, Jim Cooper of Tennessee, issued a statement saying that we're fooling the American people. We don't tell them the truth about the bottom line. And the reality is that all of our numbers are delusional. We're living in a delusional nation that is headed for bankruptcy because of intellectually corrupt politicians and presidents. Now, I wouldn't mind if they stole a few bucks. Mayor Haig used to steal money and run a very clean, very, very efficient city in New Jersey. But they don't steal any money. They just spend it, which is worse than stealing because they spend 20 times more than they could steal. And the trouble is that congressmen, presidents, government bureaucrats are mainly ignorant of the operation of the government. There is nobody in charge.
And what about the media's role? Where are they being the public watchdogs and reporting that these figures are so deceptive and that there's so much of this wasteful spending going on?
The media are no longer journalists. When I started in Washington, you could get media whose personal loyalty was either Democrat or Republican to report fairly. Now, most of the media people are liars. I, by myself, do more work on uncovering government stupidity, waste, ignorance, failure, than all 2,000 journalists in the city of Washington, D.C. These are mostly whores. They're mostly politicians masquerading as journalists. So what they do is they want to advance the liberal left-wing cause, so they lie every day. I can't get a single mainstream media to cover this book. Most of it has happened in my first book. I've written six books on government. My first one was 17 years ago, and at that time it wasn't as bad. For example, the day the book came out, I was on Good Morning America, and I went on CBS, I went on NBC. They mostly were not so much on my side, but they realized it was big news. Today, it makes no difference what it is. These whores are the most destructive people in the United States. They're more destructive than a congressman because the congressmen openly say, I'm a Republican or a Democrat. These whores say, we're journalists, but actually they're party workers. They're just the same as a party worker of the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee. And the answer is that when you get universities that are corrupt and you get the media that are corrupt, you no longer have a nation. This is what happened to France before World War II. All the newspapers were bought off and they were members of the political party. And Léon Blum, the prime minister, refused to extend the Maginot Line across Belgium and Holland because he said it cost too much. The reality was that the Socialist Party was pacifist, and Hitler marched in. We are bereft of common sense in every area, and the government lies all the time. I can't find a single instance of the government telling the truth. Let's say the question of oil. They say, we want to be self-sufficient in energy. Well, Alaska has one tremendous well, Prudhoe Bay, produces 17% of all America's oil. It's flanked on each side by much larger federal lands wells. Not one teacup of oil has been produced by the federal lands of Alaska since it became a state. And the reason is that the state drills on its land, but they only own 21% of Alaska. 79% is owned by the federal government, who stole the land when Alaska applied for statehood. In the Rocky Mountains, the U.S. Geological Study says there are three times more oil in four states in the mountains than in all of Saudi Arabia, and you don't even have to drill. It's in shale, and all you have to do is heat the shale, and the oil flows out. There's a chemical called kerogen, which is half liquid, half solid in the shale, and three times more oil in Saudi Arabia. You can't touch it because of, quote, endangered species. This is a plot. Politics in America is a plot to destroy the country, and the politicians are the main conspirators. And we're headed for disaster, and the American people are beginning to wake up because of all the spending and the depression combined. But to really wake up the American people, they have to be educated. Well, the media is supposed to educate them by uncovering corruption, but they don't uncover corruption. They uncover scandal. They uncover scandal. And even the conservative TV and all give you good emotional context that the country is going down the drain, but nobody gives you the details, and the details are all in my book.
Well, I have to agree. Your books are amazingly packed with factual, detailed information. And so let's go into a couple of the different things that you say are leading us down this suicidal path. One thing you talk about, illegal immigration, and you use the estimate, the figure of 20 million, while most still use this figure of 12 million that has been around for so many years.
It's at least 20 million.
Right. And you talk about how the 14th Amendment is misinterpreted to mean that children born to illegal immigrants automatically become citizens at age 18. Tell us about this and how it is affecting America's
senator,
future.
The senator who wrote the bill in 1866 says it was not meant to cover children of foreigners. The amendment itself says that. It says that the people have to be under the jurisdiction of the United States. Then they're offspring of citizens. We know that the people from Mexico are not under the jurisdiction of the United States, under the jurisdiction of Mexico. And so several countries played with this stupidity, including Ireland and Britain and Australia, and they gave it up because they realized how damaging and stupid it was. So we're the only country in the world now who gives citizenship to illegal immigrants. We don't even give citizenship to the children of diplomats, but all you got to do is be a Mexican and walk across the border, and your children. Now, several million new citizens of illegals, and the mathematics is frightening because if you get 20 million people who are twice as fertile as the regular Americans, and you go to two generations, children and grandchildren, you're going to have about 50 million illegal American citizens who change the whole physiognomy. This all happened under Lyndon Johnson in the Immigration Act of 1965, which stopped the system of giving visas proportionate to the ethnic basis of Americans. If Irishmen were 10% of American Irish Americans, then Ireland got 10%. They closed that, and they had family regathering. Now, who were the recent immigrants? Were the Mexicans and Filipinos, so they're the ones who got it. My people came from Hungary in 1873. I don't know anybody in Hungary, so I can't bring anybody in, but they brought in the whole families, cousins, uncles, everything. So basically, the whole demographics changed because there is a plot to destroy America. There's a plot to destroy America, and it includes the media, it includes the Democratic Party, it includes the universities, and the Republicans, who are patriotic, are stupid from the neck up.
Okay. Is there someone or some institution that is the wizard behind this whole plot that you could identify?
Well, I was a national official of the Democratic Party. I ran the Stevenson Movement in much of New York, and I was a delegate to the convention. I ran John Kennedy's vice presidential thing at the convention in New York. And little by little, the left wing, people who used to vote communist and socialist, decided they were getting nowhere. Their total under Henry Wallace Progressive Party, which was communist socialist, got only 1 million votes. They said, hey, this is moronic. Let's just take over the Democratic Party. So what's happened is that they've taken over the Democratic Party, so we have an enemy within the nation. Mm-hmm. And the enemy is so popular that it controls the universities. The university presidents of the major universities are all left-wingers. I taught college for 15 years. The environment was totally anti-American. I never heard a good word said. I went to NYU. I was a professor at NYU, adjunct professor. I never heard a good word said about America. Everything was America's racist, America's this, America's that. So basically, nations don't fall from the outside generally. They generally fall from the inside. Nobody invaded the Soviet Union. It disappeared because it was corrupt inside. We are becoming an intellectually corrupt nation.
Let me get into a couple other things. We're running out of time. I'd love to have you back, but let me conflate a couple of my questions, because you describe health care treatment for an illegal immigrant who may not speak in English versus an uninsured American citizen, and you gave it at a Dallas hospital, but also bring in, you know, you did a whole book, I know, The Doctor is a Penetrating Analysis of the American Physician and His Practice of Medicine. So bring that into our current healthcare debate, and what is this, you know, if a program like this passes, what it's going to do to our country?
Well, first of all, the president, like all presidents, is a psychopathic liar. He says we can't insure the illegals, because that sounds good politically. You don't have to insure the illegals. They have cradle to grave of free medical care. I live in part of Connecticut that's adjacent to New York, and in the New York area was all illegals in Portchester, and they kept going to the hospital, and the hospital had to close down because it couldn't exist because there was no money, and the 1986 law said that if you walk into the emergency room, you must get full care, whether you have cancer or a broken bone or liver disease. So basically, that hospital closed down, so now they all come to our hospital, and we have almost no illegals here, and they're bankrupting our hospital. And the reason is that if they have a cold, they go to the emergency room. Instead of a $40 visit, it's a $500 visit, nothing less than $500 when you walk into the emergency room. So they're bankrupting our medical system. Parkland Hospital in Texas revealed in detail what happens. A woman circles the hospital until her water breaks, and then she rushes in, $4,000 to $5,000 delivery, and then she gets a perambulator, she gets a formula, she gets all kinds of nursing care, and they have to have a Spanish translator to take care of her. And meanwhile, if you're a citizen of Dallas and you go to that same hospital and you're not insured, they sue you. So the illegals get free care and continuous care, prenatal, postnatal, everything. And then, so the situation is that we have a crazy country, and it all comes from guilt, and guilt creates suicide. Why Americans are guilty about Mexico? Maybe because we had a war with them in 1845. This all happens because the educational system keeps saying that you're not good, you have to do more. And what we do is not for ourselves, we do for them. Now, the poor, we do too much for the poor because the poor are killing the country because they refuse to pay taxes through the politicians. The politicians have set it up so that 50% of America, half of the country, pay no IRS taxes. They pay the Social Security tax, but 25 million of those who pay no taxes get the Social Security taxes back, plus cash in the earned income tax credit, where you're allowed to earn up to $42,000 a year and still get a government subsidy. So half the country is paying for the other half, and if you have half who don't pay any taxes, they don't care about the budget or the debt or anything else. They're living like retired gentlemen on Section 8 housing. Here in my town, a two-bedroom apartment costs $2,000. People on Section 8 pay $400, move into this luxury apartment, while a person who has to pay $2,000 rent has to earn $2,700 after taxes to pay the $2,000. So we have a crazy country where half have no vested interest in the sanctity and strength of the country. And that's been all set up, A, by the Democratic Party, but with the connivance of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bush was one of the great spenders. His budget went up 7% a year when inflation was 3%, and he promised to cut the budget, and instead he put us in $3 trillion more debt. So we have no political party, and the only solution to America is what George Washington said. On his farewell address at Francis Tarvin, he says the political parties will destroy America. And as soon as he left, Jefferson started a party, and Adams started the opposing Federalist Party. And those two parties still exist, and they're destroying the country. Now, certain cities have decided
to wrap this up. So let me ask you, is there a hopeful note? And please, since the media won't cover your book, tell people how they can find your books and the website. But first, can we reverse this suicidal path that we are on?
Only if you get educated. By the way, my book is doing very well. It's number one in public policy on Amazon, and Amazon has it on sale. Instead of $15, it's $10. And the reversal comes from the beginning of a movement to eliminate politics from the governing of America. First of all, we need a chief executive. The president's only chief politician. We need somebody to manage the government. But more important, we have to eliminate the parties. People should run for Congress, for mayor, for president, nonpartisan, on their own, responsible only to the Constitution and to the country. Right now, they're only responsible to the leader of the party. Nancy Pelosi waves a stick, and people who might be good Americans vote anti-American. And you've got to change that. Politics is an evil activity, and we need a nonpartisan country. We have to listen to George Washington. Whether that ever happens, I don't know. Also, we need a bill that says, a constitutional amendment that says no money can be appropriated without a 60% vote of both houses of Congress.
The book is called National Suicide, How Washington is Destroying the American Dream from A to Z. I highly recommend this to everyone. The author, Martin Gross, check him on Amazon. You'll see these amazing books that no one else has done anything like. And it's been great having you on, and there's so much more to talk about. I hope we can get you back on here.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, sir.
And God bless this country, which used to be magnificent.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Take care. Now I'm going to introduce my co-host, Don Irvine, the chairman of Accuracy and Media. You there, Don?
I'm here, Roger.
Okay, and I believe Andrew Moylan is on the line also, right?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Okay. Well, Don, I'm going to hand this one over to you and take it away.
All right. Well, I'm just going to start with a brief intro. Andrew Moylan is the Director of Government Affairs for the National Taxpayers Union, where he lobbies on federal and state issues, conducts policy research and analysis, assists in taxpayer education efforts, and formulates reports and opinion pieces. His writings have appeared in such publications as The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Times, Investor Daily, and Forbes Magazine. It's an accomplished resume there, Andrew.
Well, I'd like to think so, but I'm more worried about all these people in Washington, D.C. with very accomplished resumes that have votes in Congress.
Well, you know, what I want to talk to you about for a few minutes today was that the National Taxpayers Union has just launched a new effort to send a message to Congress about health care reform. Can you give me an explanation about what this effort is?
Yeah, well, here's the gist of it. So as some people may know, we helped to organize the 9/12 March on Washington, where we had hundreds of thousands of people who showed up and marched and culminated in a big rally on the west front of the Capitol, where we were trying to send a message about the fact that our government's out of control. So that day, we had one of our staffers with a video camera going around and taking just quick interviews of people and saying, what's your message to your member of Congress? And so we're now burning all of those messages to DVD and personally delivering them to those congressional offices. But we were thinking, you know, there are hundreds of thousands more people who wanted to come, who couldn't come, and who want to send messages to their members of Congress as well. And so what we've done is we're basically saying to people, if you send us a short video, this time specifically on health care, we will burn that message to DVD and we will hand deliver it to your member of Congress as a way to sort of deliver that message in a different way, in a way that, they, you know, a lot of these emails get deleted or just get categorized one way or another, and even phone calls sometimes, but this is a way where you can actually put somebody's face and name right in front of somebody. So we hope that people take the opportunity.
So how are you going to get the message out about this, though, this effort that you're doing? I mean, I think there's a timeline or a deadline on this that you'd like to have everything in by, too, right?
Yeah, we'd like to, if possible, have all of the videos in by Friday, October 9th. And the reason that we, you know, put any kind of a deadline on it is because at some point, you know, folks in Congress are going to start moving this bill forward. And so if we have these messages, we want to make sure that they get in before those votes actually happen. So if, you know, people who are listening can go to www.ntu.org, our website. We have a link to this right on the front page. Or we also have a special link for it. You can go to tr.im/a special delivery, and you can go there and respond directly through YouTube as well.
So after this week, where do you think we stand in terms of health care reform? Do you think we're likely to see something passing here in the near future? Or?
Well, I don't know if I'd say likely to happen in the near future. I mean, they still have a lot of work to do to get their folks on board, the Democrats do. You know, they had a couple of votes in committee on the public option, and they had several Democrats voting against a public option. You know, a government-run plan, which is sort of the hallmark of their whole idea here. And so I think that they've got a lot of work to do. I'm not sure that they can get all of that work done in the next couple of weeks. But I do think that, you know, we have to give them credit for being smart enough to realize that having a 60-vote majority in the Senate and something like a 78-seat advantage in the House is not something that's going to come along very often. And so, you know, if they're ever going to pass something, now's the time to do it.
Well, does the National Taxpayers Union have a position or in terms of an outlook of what health care reform should look like or, you know, down the line?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've long advocated for some more common sense solutions. You know, we've always supported the ability to buy insurance across state lines. I think that one of the major problems that we have is the fact that our system is employer-based. That's a cause of a lot of this sort of frictional lack of insurance that, you know, when you take a snapshot, certain people don't have insurance. If you take a same snapshot 6 months later, a lot of those people do, but a lot of other people have lost their jobs in the meantime and don't. And so trying to get at that system. And really, I think that the bigger issue in healthcare are the runaway costs of our entitlement programs, Medicare and Medicaid in particular. And that's something that, you know, people talk about a healthcare crisis. That's a real crisis. That's something that's going to bring our federal budget collapsing down on top of us in the near future if we don't tackle it. And yet what we're talking about in Congress is really adding on to a lot of these unfunded liabilities.
Well, that's a good point because, I think there's an article that just came out today talking about the effect of, you know, Medicare and Medicaid and what's happening with the state budgets because all these people have been thrown out of work. A lot of people are now applying for these entitlements earlier than expected and predicted. It's putting severe pressure on the budgets. What's going to happen here? Are we going to see a collapse?
You know, I would like to think that the answer is no, but I have yet to be convinced that people in Congress really understand the gravity of this problem. I mean, we have $50 trillion plus in unfunded entitlement liabilities. And, you know, that's a number that sounds so goofy as though somebody just made it up. And so it's hard to really conceptualize. But the bottom line is that we're going to have to see taxes rise dramatically or services cut dramatically in order to be able to, or frankly both, in order to be able to bridge this gap if we don't start tackling this problem now. And so, you know, I worry a little bit because when you look at what happened with the financial crisis last year and the bailouts, that was a problem that was staring a lot of people in the face for a very long time, and they continued to ignore it. And I worry that the same thing is going to happen on entitlement programs.
Now, the other thing you mentioned, too, was just this portability issue. What is the roadblock? What's the hurdle there in terms of getting something like that done?
I think the roadblock is mostly political, that there are a lot of Democrats who say, well, if we allow people to buy insurance across state lines, it'll be a race to the bottom where we'll have these bare-bones plans. And, of course, I don't think that that argument makes much sense because you know, people will be able to purchase the plans that they think make sense for them, ones that have, you know, a ton of services and cost a ton of money, or some that have fewer services and cost a more modest amount of money. But I don't think that there's a whole lot of, you know, maybe I'm being biased here, but I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of logic behind the opposition to it as much as there is politics.
Now, one thing that I'm curious about, too, is just that we'll have a presidential election coming up in a few years. Obviously, Mitt Romney is a leading candidate for the Republicans on this. He was largely responsible for health care reform in Massachusetts, and he's been taking a lot of heat for that. What's your position or the NTU's position on you know, Romney care and
yeah,
how it's turned out?
Well, he's been taking heat for that, and as well he should. I mean, what we're talking about today, the Democrats' preferred plan is Romney care plus a public option. What my sort of just personal guess as to what may end up passing is basically Romney care, which is, you know, a thumbnail sketch of that is an individual mandate forcing you to purchase insurance and fining you if you don't. Huge amounts of subsidies for not just low income, but moderate income and even, you know, folks that a lot of people would consider very much middle class, subsidies for them to purchase that insurance, and a sort of a government managed health insurance exchange, which would place, you know, strict regulations on what an insurance plan could look like, what sort of things must be covered, and all of that. And so that's basically Romney care that, you know, may end up passing in the United States Congress. And I don't think that that's been a tremendous success for Massachusetts. Costs have not come down. The wait times there for medical services are still substantial. And so it hasn't been something that's been a panacea for them, and so I don't think it would be something that would work very well on the federal level either.
Well, great. Andrew, I really appreciate taking the time today. We're kind of out of time for this segment. Is there anything else you want to say real quickly to our listeners about health care reform or taxes?
Well, the thing that I would say to them is, you know, we're talking about this video program that we're doing now. I would encourage people, whether they do it through that or not, just to contact their members of Congress and let them know how they feel about this, because you know, you're paying their salaries and your voice is what's important here. And, you know, if you don't weigh in, then we're going to be stuck with a $1 trillion government takeover of health care. And I don't think that that's something that most people want.
Well, great. Well, thank you once again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Great interview, Don. We now have on the line Virginia Walden Ford. Are you there, Ms. Ford?
I am.
Hi, welcome to Take Aim, and thank you for coming on our show today. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine.
Well, thank you for having me.
Ms. Ford is the Executive Director of the D.C. Black Alliance for Educational Options and has been fighting to preserve the Opportunity Scholarship Program in Washington, D.C. Tell us how you came to this struggle and why you have so much passion for it.
Well, I actually came as a parent. About 15 years ago, I had a child that was failing in school, so we know it's been going on that long, and was just invisible. And it just seemed so important to speak out on his behalf. Right at that time, he got a scholarship from a private citizen to go to any school I chose, and I chose a Catholic high school for him, which just turned his life around. And it just seemed, once we had such a happy ending and he was doing well, I needed to invest time into making sure that others had the same opportunities.
And what is the Opportunity Scholarship Program here in Washington, and how many students participate?
The Opportunity Scholarship Program is a program that was signed into law. It's called the D.C. School Choice Incentive Act in 2004 by President Bush, that provides a $7,500 scholarship for low-income kids to go to 55 private schools in D.C. Currently, there are 1,715 children in the program.
Virginia, this is Don Irvine.
Hi, Don.
How you doing? Can you explain to me why voucher programs are a big part of the answer to our failing school systems?
Well, you know, the public school system is calls itself trying to reform itself, but it's too slow. And we can no longer tell parents we don't have any choices for them and just, you know, allow their children to go to schools that are not serving them well. So I think that any option that's available, particularly for low-income families, is really important right now. We're going to continue to lose generations of kids to an educational system that is not serving them well. We have to be able to give them other things to do for their children rather than keep them in schools in their neighborhoods. So these programs have allowed us to say to parents, you don't have to go to schools that are not doing well in your communities. There are other things you can do. And the kids in this program have done incredibly well.
Didn't President Obama said that he would support this program, and has he?
What he said was that he would make sure that the children that are currently in the program are protected. That has not been done. We believe that it will probably be done at some point, but it hasn't been done at this point. So right now the program is in danger of ending the end of the school year unless it's reauthorized by Congress.
Now, also, didn't the president, when Obama was campaigning, that he'd do so on merit pay for teachers, expansion of charter schools, you know, mm-hmm. two things that the teachers unions aren't too friendly about, don't look kindly on. How's he done on those promises?
Well, he's been, you know, supporting charter schools to a certain extent. So they're feeling pretty good. I guess some of the stimulus money is going to make sure that states have the money to support the charter schools, which we certainly agree with. But as far as this program is concerned, one of the things he said was he would support programs that work no matter what the ideology, and this program works. We have evaluations from the Department of Ed that show that the kids are making academic strides. So why not this program? You know, why not support a program that works as he said he would do? And this one certainly is working.
So these charter schools, one thing that strikes me about them is it seems like there's so few of them that they don't really give it the full chance to see what would happen if every parent was given a voucher to take their own child to whatever school they wanted, and to see how then schools would really compete to get those vouchers.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the charter schools in D.C., there are a lot of them. There are 64 charter schools and 99 campuses and 30,000 kids in charter schools, but they're waiting lists. And so it's not the absolute answer. Kids that we had 216 kids whose scholarships were revoked by the Department of Ed, and we tried to help them find charter schools. In almost every case, those schools were full and had waiting lists. So most of those children were forced to go back to traditional public schools in their communities. So, you know, we believe that all of the options should be available to parents, and that's what I don't think that the current administration gets.
Okay, why don't they, and why do the Democrats always have a hard time and just want to barely fund these things almost at, you know, at the point of a gun practically? They don't really seem to like it. What is it? Is it involvement with unions? And tell us about that relationship.
You know, I, in my opinion, and of the opinion of many reformers, that the reason is because the teachers' unions are really directing how any reform in education is carried out, and which is just crazy to us. I mean, the bottom line should be we all should be working for the benefit of children, and the teachers' union should not, or a special interest group, should not have the opportunity to say what will happen to kids. Parents need to be able to drive that.
Okay. So, but, you know, people would wonder, well, aren't the teachers' unions, these are the people who are there with them every day, with the students, don't they want to see the kids succeed, or are they that wrapped up in their union, and what is it? How do you explain that?
Yeah, I believe they are wrapped up in their union. I mean, years ago, we used to hear the teachers' unions said that their client are the teachers, you know, and which absolutely made no sense to us. And, you know, since the teachers are the ones that are serving the children. But, you know, it has become this whole political fight is a way of controlling, if you will, the people that have say-so over what happens to children. And I think that's just horrific. I think it's just awful that they have an opportunity to direct this journey that the kids are taking by holding back teachers. I have friends that teach in public education who are constantly complaining about not being able to move forward with creative ideas to help students learn because they're held back by the unions. I think it gets to be, you know, they worry about the adults and nobody's worrying about the kids. And unfortunately, they have deep pockets, so, you know, they can give the money to campaigns and kind of hold elected officials at ransom because of that money. You know, they can't make those decisions for kids. You know, our position is that this should not even be a discussion about what happens with adults when kids are doing so poorly in urban centers, in public education. It has to be only about kids, and that just is not happening.
Don?
Virginia, let me ask you about yesterday you had a big event, this rally. Can you talk to me about that a little bit? It was a pretty good turnout. Looks like you had lots of media coverage as well.
Yeah, we had lots of media coverage, even though, interestingly, I didn't see a lot of coverage on TV last night. The media was certainly out there, and so I found that kind of interesting. But there were 3,300 parents, kids, supporters. We had incredible speakers, former Secretary Margaret Spelling, former Mayor Marion Barry, Senator Anthony Williams from Pennsylvania, who incidentally brought a group of Pennsylvania parents in support of school choice here. It was a phenomenal event. I mean, I cannot even imagine us not getting any attention, though we've not gotten any attention from the White House or from the Secretary. We did get a lot of support from Congress members. There were several members that came out, Congressman Boehner, Congressman Hoekstra. So we got beautiful messages from Senator Lieberman, Senator Feinstein, and others. So there's a lot of support. To me, it's beginning. It felt yesterday like it was bipartisan and that the people that were there came because they cared for kids or the people that send messages. And I was hopeful. I was really encouraged. I came home and I felt for the first time in a long time that the children's needs were going to be looked at rather than political needs.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that struck me was just this wide diversity of the speakers in terms of the people that are supporting this.
Absolutely.
Why isn't it that the politicians aren't getting this message? I mean, you mentioned, you know, John Boehner and Peter Hoekstra. You've got some of the Republicans that are in your corner there, but
yep.
The Democrats, a lot of these liberal politicians, you know, they talk about, yes, you know, we're interested in education, we want equal opportunity, but for some reason it kind of gets, you know, stumbles across the way. I think the Wall Street Journal was reporting yesterday, too, about Dick Durbin, that he would revisit this issue, but he wanted testing done, which would add an extra level of testing for the students in the school choice program.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's just that whole political thing. that has marred school choice programs all over the country. If the Republicans came up with it first, then the Democrats fight against it. I think they forget who they're fighting for. I think they forget that this is not just politics, that it is about kids and it's about the future of this country. You know, we've been very fortunate in D.C. over the last few months because we have seen a lot of activity coming from the Democrats, people that are saying, you know, it's just right to support children. Not enough, and we hope that yesterday's rally show those folks that are struggling with how to make a decision about whether to support us, that the parents and the kids and so many people are supportive of school choice all nationally, not just the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, but programs that are in place that are really working for kids. You know, if the traditional public school system who claims to be in the midst of reform, but it takes time to reform schools that are bad, Chicago, New York, D.C., and we have to have something else to give parents in the meantime, or we're going to continue to lose generations of kids. There's too many kids getting killed on the streets. I hear too many sad stories, and I believe with all my heart that people on both sides of the aisles are beginning to see that. Now, will they speak out about it? That's yet to be seen. Some are. You know, Senator Williams from Pennsylvania was very passionate yesterday. The council in D.C. is supporting the program. We have a majority of the council members supporting the program. Former Mayor Tony Williams has been an outspoken advocate for the program, and so has former Councilman Kevin Chavis, who has become our leader. So people are beginning to see that what we have to do is what's right versus how they're going to be politically affected. But it's just not enough, you know, and I think it just goes back to the old days of the battles between the parties, you know, and people have got to stop doing it. Years ago, Harold Ford voted on our behalf for this program, and when we went to thank him, I said, I know this probably has affected you politically to go against your party because we did not have Democratic support at that time. And he said, you know, you just got to do what's right sometimes. And that's what I want people to think about. I want that to be the message that goes to Congress, to the president, to the secretary. Sometimes you just got to do what's right.
So how do you...
Go ahead, Roger.
How do you explain the overwhelming support by African Americans for the Democratic Party when it seems to work against their interests in key ways such as this?
Well, you know, I think it's just comes from the old civil rights, movement. Mm-hmm. A lot of African Americans believed that that Democrats were more on their side during the civil rights movement. I'm not a Democrat, so I can't explain how people think, but I'm Republican and have been my whole entire adult life. But, you know, I think it comes from those days. I think that, you know, people have gotten so accustomed going from generation to generation having what they believe Democrats stand up for that they're not rethinking how it benefits or affects their families or their lives. And so I think that, you know, I think we have to relook at those things. We have to, I told a group of parents yesterday, sometimes we have to, because we run into problems because so many African Americans supported President Obama. And so they believe that in the 11th hour he's going to, you know, get up and save this program. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I have to explain that that may not happen because the party does not support this program. And it's painful almost to see their reaction to it because they believe so much in him and the fact that he was going to be a president that would, care and direct his attention to some of the issues in our communities. But that's really tough. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I've had this discussion within my own family, and they still hold strong to the fact that this president is going to save them. And but I think it comes from just years ago. I think we have gone from generation to generation voting like our parents voted. I was very lucky. My parents were Republicans, but No, so even if I did vote the way they voted the way I believe. So,
well,
you know,
we're gonna have to wrap this up in a minute. But let me ask you: have you tried to get a meeting with either Arne Duncan or the president himself to talk about this?
Absolutely. Our leadership has been having continual meetings with Arne Duncan and Jim Shelton and not the president so much. We've tried to follow protocol, but the rally was up in the ante. It was moving the fight up a level, and as okay. Kevin Chavis says, we will fight to the end on this. Our kids
is there,
are not
is there a website? Is there a website people can visit to learn more about this and you and get involved?
Yep, it's SaveSchoolChoice.com.
SaveSchoolChoice.com.
Yes.
Okay, Virginia Walden Ford, thank you so much for being with us today on Take Aim, and wish you the best with this, and keep fighting. You're doing a great job, and we think it's really important work that you're doing, and thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you for having me, and call me anytime.
Okay, folks, and we will be back next week for another great show on Take Aim. And till then, have a great week, and we'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.